Andrew Porter has been the classical music critic for The New Yorker magazine since 1972. His fellow music critic Richard Dyer of the Boston Globe praises Porter for his commitment to new music and his intellectual curiosity. Dyer writes, "Of all today's critics in English, Porter is the most satisfying for the simple reason that he knows the most." Porter's New Yorker reviews from 1980 to 83 have been collected in a new book titled Musical Events. He joins us today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked Andrew Porter to pick out some pieces of music that hold special meaning for him. We'll start with Joan Morris and William Balcom performing Rings on My Fingers.
Jim O'Shea was cast away upon an Indian isle. The natives there, they liked his hair, they liked his Irish smile. They named him Chief Panjandrum, the nabob of them all. They called him Jitty Bob Jay and rigged him out so gay. So he wrote to Dortmund Bay to his sweetheart just to say, "Sure, I've got rings on me fingers, bells on me toes, elephants to ride upon, my little Irish rose. Woo! Come to your nabob and on next path."
Andrew Porter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello.
You know, you had told me that this Joan Morris record was a favorite of yours. I really like her singing as well. Tell me what you admire so much about her singing.
Oh, I love the sound of it, but more important, perhaps, I love the way she uses words. I mean, listen to the way she sings Rings and Elephants. And it's not a great song. Of course, it's not a great song. It's written early this century by Maurice Scott. But what she does with it is what the singers I admire most also do with Mozart and with Wagner and with Verdi and with a modern songwriter like Ned Roram. Feel the words, pronounce the words, time them marvelously.
You know, once when I interviewed her a few years ago, she told me that she really admired the pronunciation of Ruth Etting.
Yes.
And Ruth Etting was a popular singer who recorded mostly in the 1930s.
Yes, I know Ruth Etting's records. I admire her very much, too.
You know, I'm very interested in how you became a critic and why you decided to become a music critic as opposed to, say, entering academia, becoming a scholar or a music historian.
I think, like many things in many people's lives, it happened almost by chance. When I was a schoolboy, I started writing for little local papers, but perhaps more important, when I was an undergraduate, well, I liked music and I liked writing. And we were having some very interesting concerts in Oxford, revivals of works by Thomas Arne. So I wrote to the editor of the Manchester Guardian and said, "We're having this first revival of Thomas Arne's Judith in something over a century, and would you like to hear about it?" And he said, as I think good editors do, "Well, send me something, and if I like it, I'll print it, and if I don't, I won't." And he did like it, and I more or less, I suppose, fell into criticism that way rather than making a conscious decision.
You came to The New Yorker in the 1970s. You came to New York to write for The New Yorker. You had previously lived in England. Was the classical music scene in New York much different than what you were used to in London?
It was, yes. Some ways it was similar. I mean, there was a big orchestra, there was the opera company. But there was more music in New York. But on the other hand, there was a smaller audience for things that really interested me, like contemporary music, above all, and serious adventurous programs. There was less of that, but there was obviously, although less, there was more than could fill one person's life. So I didn't feel deprived in any way.
Now, I know you took a leave of absence from The New Yorker in 1981 to teach for a while. I think you taught at the University of California. Did you like the academic world when you were in it?
I liked it very well for a year. I don't think I'd like to live in it forever. It's very nice coming in as an outsider, as a visiting professor, and not having to involve yourself in local politics or local power struggles at all. I loved the teaching, and I was very glad that the teaching was all I had to do.
Is the language of academia different than the language of magazines?
What I think I was trying to do in one of my classes in Berkeley was a seminar called Writing About Music. And I think what I was trying to do there was to bring the two things together, to show that because one was writing stiff musicology, one didn't have to write in an unattractive way.
Now, in one of your New Yorker pieces, you're reviewing a piece by Milton Babbitt, And he has taught, at the time he had taught at Princeton for more than 40 years, and you criticized his program notes about his compositions as being repellent, and you quote a line of the program notes, and the line was, "Models of similar interval-preserving, registrally uninterpreted pitch class and metrically duration uninterpreted time point aggregate arrays." That was the
yes. That's not going to make you think you're going to hear a nice, jolly piece of music, is it?
No, I thought that was rather incomprehensible. But I guess that's the kind of writing that you criticize and try to avoid like the plague yourself.
Well, so far as I can, yes. I must say that I love Milton's music. I mustn't. It's just when he puts this bad face upon it that I think, well, why does he?
In another one of your reviews, you said something that made me very aware of your plight as a music critic. You said that there are still Haydn quartets and Bach cantatas and Monteverdi madrigals that you've never heard, so that you really want to be careful with your time, because there's still so much of the past to catch up on that you don't want to be listening to just anything.
I wonder if
even though it's new.
Yes, I wonder if most people don't feel that in some way or another. I mean, books they haven't read or countries they haven't visited and so on. Time's getting on for me. I mean, I must think about it, yes. I ration my time. Ration is not right. I select what I go to rather carefully, because I don't think a critic is going to write well about something he doesn't really want to hear and doesn't feel a basic interest in hearing.
One of your priorities is keeping up with new music. And I've asked you to bring several records with you, and one of the records you brought is a piece by Elliot Carter, and I'd like for you to say something about it before we play an excerpt of this piece.
Well, I brought this piece along deliberately because it seems to me a good example of contemporary music which is, in any description, would seem enormously complicated. It's called Symphony of Three Orchestras. Three orchestras are laid out on the stage, each plays a different kind of music. In the most elaborate and intricate overlapping kind of way. But if one just listens to it, one can also hear that it is a tone poem about New York. It's an extremely romantic piece. There's a kind of romance about America, which I think all Europeans feel, which I certainly felt very much. I mean, as a schoolboy, I used to sing the settings of Whitman by Vaughan Williams, and this gave one a kind of romantic feel. I think one of the first things any visitor to New York does is to walk over Brooklyn Bridge. It's one of the most marvellous things one can do. It's a great sort of elevation, both literally and of the spirits. And this piece of Elliot Carter's is based on a poem by Hart Crane about Brooklyn Bridge, the big poem, The Bridge. And it starts, as the poem starts, with a feeling of walking over Brooklyn Bridge, and a seagull is in flight, winging its way over the Great Bay. And Carter writes a big trumpet solo. And with that in mind, I don't see how anybody could think this is difficult, complicated music, but a really wonderfully romantic tone poem about life in this great city.
Well, let's give it a spin.
See what you think.
Okay, and we'll hear Pierre Boulez conducting the New York Philharmonic.
And shall I add that the trumpeter, which is interesting, is Gerard Schwartz, who's now made a big name for himself as a conductor, but then he was first trumpet of the Philharmonic.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
Andrew Porter, I imagine you've heard this piece many times. Do you find that your reaction has changed from your first hearing to how you react to it now?
Romantic reactions, no, not at all. I mean, they're as strong as ever. It is also, as I say, a complicated piece structurally, and of course I do get my learn my way around it by hearing it that way. But first reaction is the same as even just hearing it again now. I just think what a marvellous, soaring, great melody that is.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. My guest is Andrew Porter, who is the music critic for The New Yorker magazine, classical music critic, and he has a new book that's an anthology of his reviews from 1980 to 83, and like his column, it's titled Musical Events. How were you introduced to new music? Did you start listening to music from other centuries before you were listening to contemporary music, or did it happen the other way around?
I suppose the newest music I was introduced to was the music I tried to write myself when I was young.
Oh, I didn't realize you'd been a composer.
Well, I think most people are, aren't they? If they're at all musical, they do try and get something down on paper. I didn't enormously like what I wrote, but in a sense, there I was, trying to write in the styles of, starting, I suppose, with Bach, because that's how one starts to learn in Palestrina and learns from counterpoint, but moving on and trying to write 12-note pieces of a not very nice nature, but getting some sort of feel for handling the stuff.
Do you find yourself gravitating towards composers of your generation? Do you feel any more in tune with them?
Than I do to Schubert and to Mozart?
No, I mean in the world of new music, in the world of contemporary music.
There are certain composers whom I've lived with and who are much the same age as I am and have watched their music, you know, coming out. I'm thinking of Hans Werner Henze now, who's a little older, but only a year or two older than I am. And I've watched all his new compositions come out and felt in some way he was writing my biography in the world as well as his and the history of music. So I do feel in tune with, yes, very much in that way. I mean, I feel in tune also with Peter Maxwell Davis, who's, again, more or less a contemporary, and I've heard his music sort of from first until the latest piece, and therefore there's a kind of context when I hear that music, which I didn't have, say, when I first came here and started listening to Elliot Carter. But now I've been in America for 15 years, and I have heard 15 years of Carter's developments, and I've worked backwards so that he also means a great deal to me.
There's a generation of composers now who grew up with rock and roll as well as with classical music. And I'm thinking of people like Philip Glass and Steve Reich. And I know you've complained in your reviews at a few concerts that you found the volume intolerably high. And I wonder if you have had any experience with rock and roll and if any of the rock and roll influenced composers make you uncomfortable when... With that kind of volume or with the influence of rock and roll?
Yes, they absolutely do. I didn't grow up with rock and roll, and I do find it sometimes very exciting and sometimes influence exciting, but physically I just simply cannot bear the noise it makes. I think it would deafen me. If I go into a disco, I can't stay there for a minute or two. This is no good. It's going to wreck my ears. And I think many people have had their ears wrecked. I mean, I came here on the subway today, and there was someone with earphones on, with a kind of racket that I could hear right across the car and through the noise of a New York subway train. What sort of hearing there is in those ears, I can't imagine. I mean, they must be physically and actually medically deafened thereby.
So what do you do if you're at a concert and you find the volume intolerable? Do you leave, move?
Now, last time that was Robert Ashley's Private Lives, and yes, I just left. I listened to some of it from outside the door. I could hear it perfectly well there.
Well, I want to talk to you more about music and music criticism, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Andrew Porter. He's the classical music critic for The New Yorker magazine, and there's a new collection of his reviews. It's titled Musical Events, A Chronicle 1980 to 1983. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. New Yorker magazine classical music critic Andrew Porter is my guest. Now, another of your musical loves is opera. And in one of your reviews, you said that you thought that singers of our day have resigned their primacy and allowed directors, designers, and conductors to take the lead and to put their stamp on the presentation. Would you explain that?
I think this has happened over a fairly long time. It's probably started when the repertory became somewhat stagnant and people still wanted to hear something new, but no longer wanted to hear new operas. Therefore, they developed a taste for hearing old operas done in a new way. and a new way might be to take Aida and set it on Mars. It's rather extravagant. I didn't really think directors were as silly as that, but that kind of thing. And that's how I think it began, that what was called the idea of concept opera, something new, let's do something different with this familiar old opera, began and has continued very strongly. I'm not totally against it. I mean, a lot can be done with bringing freshness, new ways of seeing things in unusual lights. But sometimes I think it's done for mere novelty and wish that... I think sometimes it would be more novel to try and do the piece as it was originally done.
Well, you've brought a performance of an aria with you to play for us today, an aria from Handel's Julius Caesar. Would you tell us about this performance and why it's so special to you?
Yes, well, what I want to try and do with this particular aria is to use it as an emblem for three things that interest me very much. One is the greatness of Handel, a composer who was always known for Messiah, of course, but whose extraordinary insight into human life in these rather apparently artificial operas really became demonstrated, I think, during the great Handel celebrations of 1986. Second, it illustrates another thing which has become increasingly important in American life. You can see it growing on all our campuses and also in the concert life of the big cities, and that is the attempt to play the music of the past on instruments of the past. A modern violin does not sound like an 18th century violin. It's a different, actually different construction. The woodwinds can be even more different. This performance I'm going to play is played on careful reconstructions or actually original instruments of a kind that Handel would have known. But perhaps most important of all, it's an aria from Handel's opera Julius Caesar. And it's called Vatacito e nascosto, l'astuto cacito. It's an aria which says, in fact, just as a skillful huntsman stalks his prey in silence, so a crafty politician hides his real motives from the world. Now, this opera, Julius Caesar, was produced by Peter Sellers, whom I admire above all other American stage directors, in a way that made this opera, written early in the 18th century, extraordinary. A vogue word is relevant, but what I mean is produced it in a way, it staged it so that one really felt that this is an opera about things we know about, that things that affect our lives. And as I'm a music critic who never believes that music is just a kind of diversion that one goes to at the end of the day, shutting the rest of life away, but music is something which permeates every moment of one's life, illuminates, it has things to do with it. I'm trying to make 2 minutes of music carry an awful charge, but anyway, that is why I've chosen this piece, because it's by Handel. It's this wonderful long melody. It's one of the greatest melodists of all time. The tune goes on and on. You think it's come to an end, but on it goes. Secondly, because it demonstrates how beautiful music can sound when the instruments are those that Handel would have known, and the singer, who is Drew Minter, by the way, is singing in a style which has been conditioned by all that we do know of the way people sang in the 18th century. And thirdly, because here is an aria which we can apply to our own lives.
Well, it's a wonderful introduction to the aria. Why don't we listen to it?
I hope it lives up to it.
Drew Minter performing my guest, Andrew Porter, the classical music critic of the New Yorker magazine. That was really quite nice.
We couldn't even get to the end of the tune. It was still going on. It was it's one of the longest melodies ever written, I think.
You know, I'd like to ask you some things that I've heard from... well, the first thing I'm going to ask you really comes directly from a classical music critic that I know in New York. And he was actually thinking of giving up music criticism because he thought that the music world in New York, the classical music world, had become very snobbish, and that he really didn't like the snobism anymore, and that it was starting to make him dislike the music. I wonder if you've had any experiences that would make you feel like that, or if you would disagree about his perception about the classical music world.
I'm wondering if he's someone who is sent a great deal to the Met, because if he...
Perhaps.
Then I think I might feel the same. I don't think that phrase, the classical musical world in New York, is it's too general, you see. I mean, it depends what part. The classical musical world in New York is as varied as any other world, and certainly if I were directed, which fortunately I'm not by my editor on The New Yorker, to attend all the Met events and to go to the Philharmonic once a week, well, I would despair. I would give up at once. But there is so much else that is not the least bit snobbish, that is young, that is fresh, that is adventurous. There are concerts in Merkin Hall. There are concerts up in Symphony Space, which is, you know, a once an ice rink, very extraordinarily shabby, but extraordinarily likable place with a very democratic audience. So, no, I mean, I would be tempted to give up a job that made me go to one particular, the elitist, not elitist at all, because I am an elitist, the fashionable side of music making. Commercial, I think, is the word I'm looking for. I certainly wouldn't, if I think I had to go and attend Pavarotti's recitals at Carnegie Hall and review them, well, of course, I'd soon despair.
So you just described yourself as an elitist. What do you mean when you say
no,
that?
No, I was jumping away from the word. I was just saying, trying not to use it one way or the other. I mean, someone who believes in high standards, uncommercialized music, not popularizing at the extent of at the expense of quality.
Do you ever feel that you've said everything you want to say, and that it's going to be hard to write, to wake up tomorrow and write about classical music? To write about classical music. Do you ever go through that?
I sometimes feel it, and then something very reassuring happens, that I go and hear some new performer, and he or she has something to say to me that I suddenly feel I've got so much more to say. I enjoyed this performance. I enjoyed it in ways I didn't expect. Perhaps even I enjoyed it in ways I did expect. Perhaps I didn't enjoy it in ways I did expect. All of those things might happen. I mean, take, for example, the Schubert recitals that are coming up, played by Alfred Brendel in New York. You could hardly have more standard repertory, but I'm looking forward to them with most enormous excitement, because Brendel will certainly, if I'm going stale, freshen me.
Are you friends with any of the composers you write about, or do you feel that you have to keep a distance from the people who are the subjects of your writing?
This is a very interesting division in criticism, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I'd like to say something about it. And forget all that. I'll just go straight into the answer now, cut all that rubbish. People are very divided in their views about how well a critic should know the people he's criticising. And I very strongly belong to the camp that feels that a critic is actually part of the whole musical scene. He should throw himself, heart and soul, into what is going on. Get to know composers, get to know performers, know how their minds work, know what their troubles are, and of course not let that influence his judgment at all. And I don't think it does. I mean, if a critic were to write more favourably about someone because he'd met her, well, he shouldn't be in the job at all. I don't take the Caesar's Wife line. It's, you know, Caesar have nothing whatsoever to do with critics. I think that simply makes them judgmental, puts them on the sidelines. I think one should plunge in and feel oneself a part of it.
You know, I really have met musicians who think that it should be the job of the critic to promote music that they like, and if they don't have something nice to say, then they shouldn't damn the musicians. And some musicians go so far as to see critics as parasites. And frankly, I think this is something that critics face in every field, that they are so resented by because of bad reviews that they give. I wonder if you've come across that, and if it makes you very angry when you do.
Angry with myself or angry with them?
Angry with them.
No, I don't. It seems to be an absolutely natural reaction. I've been reviewed. I mean, now think of what Charles Rosen once wrote about me in the New York Review of Books. But I mean, we're still friends. One can make the social distinction. Peter Brook wrote very interestingly about this in his book, The Empty Space, saying that there were so many advantages for a critic to have a hands-on approach, and the only disadvantage could be some small, slight social inconvenience. And a small price to pay for anything that makes great for greater understanding.
I have found with myself that as I get older, I seem to be more willing to stop in the middle of a book and say, I don't really think I like this book, I'm going to stop it and read another one instead. Or to take a needle off a record and say, I'm going to save this time for a record that seems more interesting. Do you do that, or do you, once you've stared at something, feel committed to going all the way through, even if it doesn't seem promising?
Well, if I'm at a concert, and I may be longing to leave, I don't think I should leave until the piece is over, because other people may be enjoying it more than I am. So, no, I don't do that. But what I do, I suppose, is switch off my mind sometimes. I think this piece has nothing to say to me, so I have the same reaction as you have, although physically I can't quite indulge in it in the same way.
I think perhaps the most embarrassing thing that could happen to a music critic at a concert would be to fall asleep at the concert and have somebody see him or her.
I think it's probably not a critic to whom that hasn't happened.
Really?
Well,
has it happened to you?
I remember once I was reviewing, this was years and years ago, I had to review a new violin concerto by a famous composer. Oh dear, I was embarrassed because I don't know whether I fell asleep, whether that in itself was a form of criticism. Yes, I'm sure it's happened to everybody.
Well, Andrew Porter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
My guest has been Andrew Porter. A collection of his columns from the New Yorker magazine from 1980 to 83 has just been published by Summit Books. It's titled Musical Events. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.